Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on 29 AM and FM radio stations 7 days a week in the United States and in more than 70 countries worldwide on the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage. That's georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the economy, a report from The Privateer, number 511. You know, when you pay a 25% tax, by the time that 25% is moved 10 transactions down the line in business, the government ends up with 95% of the original amount of money transacted. Let me show you why. Let's suppose that you wanted to buy something from me, a used motorcycle, for $1,200. You'd have to earn $1,600 so that you could pay a 25% income tax, $400, to net $1,200 to give to me. Now, I take the $1,200 and I have to pay a 25% tax. That's $300. And so that leaves me with $900 to go out and spend in the marketplace. And by the time I spend my $900 and give it to you or somebody else, you've got to pay your 25% tax. And that means then that you're left with $675, and then it's $506, $379, $284, and so on down the line. By the time we take that $1,600 and it moves through 10 transactions, the government ends up with 95% of the $1,600 in just 10 transactions. Now, for more information about tax and status, why don't you call me at 417-273-4967, and be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. That's a 4-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. Remember, it's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, and best of all, it's free of charge. And my tax and status school is on compact disc for adult home education. And if you're online, just go to the website georgegordon.org, click onto the email, and send me an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we've been reviewing The Privateer. Now, The Privateer is an economics newsletter that comes out of Australia. I recommend it highly to all of my listeners and all of my students, so that you can keep abreast of what's really going on in the world, because what you hear on the media is contrived news. It's like, years ago, we used to laugh at the Russians because they got all of their news from Izvestia, the government news service. And of course, the government told the Russian people what the Russian government wanted them to know. Well, today, all of the news in the world is centralized through three sources. It's either UPAP or Reuters. And those are controlled by people like Warren Buffett, or George Soros, or some other media mogul somewhere. In the United States, most of the news organizations, that is, the television stations, the newspapers, etc., are owned by six big major communications companies. And those six companies are multi-billion dollar multinational institutions. And they tell us what they want us to know. And then there's an underground press. You know, there's a source of information that you can get here and there, not centralized, but here and there. And this is one of those sources of information. There's many of them. There's little newsletters that are published, probably 1,000 of them or so in the United States. I don't know exactly, but I'd say there's 1,000. And you get little bits and pieces and dribs and drabs. You want to find out what's going on or what Ralph Nader believes and so on. You look around and you'll find some letter somewhere, some newsletters that'll tell you, well, here's what I think and here's what I believe and here's what I'm doing. But you see, the major news medias and the major political parties just freeze out everybody else. They don't want any competition. So Ralph Nader cannot participate in the debates. Neither can the Libertarian Party candidate. So you don't know very much about the Libertarians. You don't know much about the Constitutionalists or Ralph Nader. All you hear are little sound bites that come from John Kerry or George Bush, and both of those boys belong to Skull and Bones, both controlled by the CFR, Trilateral Commission, Bilderbergers, and the big policy think tanks around the world, the Tavistock Institute and so on. And so we get pablum, which is fine. You and I aren't going to change anything in Iraq. You and I aren't going to change anything in the economy. But our perception of Iraq and our perception of the economy causes us to take actions. You're going to buy a new car this year, or you're going to buy a new house, or you're going to pay off your credit cards, or you're going to withhold, or you're going to postpone buying that house or that car or something, based upon your perceptions that you get from Dan Rather or Tom Brokaw or from somebody around you. Now, if you just lost your job, you're probably one of the people that are going to postpone major purchases. If you just got a job, maybe you're going to go out and buy something big. And that's what stimulates the American economy. After all, two-thirds of it, 67%, they tell us now, is stimulated by, driven by, consumerism. And our balance of payments deficit is now up over a half a trillion dollars a year. I mean, it's so gigantic, it's so astronomical. And it just got that way in the last 3 or 4 years. I mean, it's since 1990 that we've just gone off the deep end. But in the last 2 or 3 years, it's gotten to the point of ridiculousness. And yet, our major political parties tell us everything's fine. Elect me because I'll do a better job than the other guy. Now, I would contend that bigger issues that need to be taken care of are things like Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security and the national debt and the budget deficits and the balance of payments deficits and so on. But, of course, that's just my opinion. I think that Iraq is more of a distraction than it is a real problem. Terrorism is a problem, but it's nothing major. If the terrorists were killing people at the rate they've been killing people around the world, they'd have to do that for the next 30 or 40 years to equal the number of dead or the number of people killed in, say, a Korea or a Vietnam, 50,000. But on the news every night we get pictures of 1, 2, 3 soldiers in Vietnam who have been killed. So last time I mentioned that this is the way to destroy the will of the American people to continue the war. It's aimed at and designed to cause you to quit. If America doesn't quit in Iraq, ultimately we'll win. I don't know if it's a week, a month, a year, or 5 years, or 10 years, or 40 years. If we just don't quit, ultimately we'll win. But Americans don't have the willpower to stay in the game. And that's because of the perceptions that we get from the news media. That news media is very powerful. They determine what you and I believe. And that's because if you repeat a lie over and over, people will believe it. It's just a peculiarity of human nature. If you lie to me over and over and over and over, at some point in time, I will accept that lie and believe it. So in order for us to keep our balance, then somebody has to tell us the truth once in a while. That gives us a point of contention. And then we can look and say, well, wait a minute, they both can't be right. And then the more information that we have, contrary information, and if we can get the truth once in a while so that the truth counterbalances the lies, then we can get our balance again and look around and say, well, wait a minute. This isn't that important. That's why you've heard me mention this from time to time. All the people killed in terrorist attacks in the United States since 1980 is under 5,000. My God, in 10 years, you know, we killed 50,000 in Vietnam. You know, we had 50,000 killed in Korea in 3 years. In 25 years, the terrorists haven't killed 5,000 in the United States. I doubt if it's even 4,000. So if you take the number of dead, it's insignificant. If you take one person at a time and put his picture up on the TV, boy, that's a tragedy. And that's what Joe Stalin pointed out. He said, you know, you kill one man, that's a tragedy. You kill a million, that's a statistic. So 58,000 dead in Vietnam is a statistic, but three Marines killed yesterday and their pictures up on the TV on the Lair News Hour. That's a tragedy. And when those tragedies are repeated over and over every night, and you watch that night after night, you've witnessed it. You see, about, I don't know, around 80% of the people favored the war, and then after they started seeing these pictures on television over the last year or so, now it's down to 50%. And if you keep after it, it'll get down to 40 and 30 and 20. Pretty soon you'll have everybody opposed to the war. And that's the way the enemy wins the war. And it's not the terrorists who control the news media. It's the Committee of 300. It's the policymakers that move and shape the world. The policymakers who are in the process of destroying the United States of America as a world power, to meld it into this new world order. So it's a contrived plan. And you and I are its victims. Now, inside the European Union, the privateer gives us a little insight. Now let's take a look at what's going on around the world from the perspective of an economics newsletter telling us what these numbers, giving us the numbers out of our own government agencies that the mainstream press ignores. They tell us about Vietnam and show us pictures of tragedies to keep our minds diverted from the real crisis that's going on around us. Vietnam was a diversion. Korea was a diversion. That keeps our minds off of what we ought to be thinking about, things that are important to us. So across Western continental Europe, political men in office look at the skies or they roll their eyes when they're asked about presidential contender Kerry's statements that he not only wants but will also get international support. For instance, Western European support in the form of European armed forces on the ground in Iraq. Off the record, the European statements are blunt. Not on your life. All right, let's think about that for a minute. The European nations had a deal going with Saddam Hussein. They were getting their oil at cut-rate prices through the UN Food for Oil program. And the United States came in there and said, well, we're going to take all the oil. You see, the news media tells us the reason we're in Vietnam is to help the Iraqi people. That's poppycock. Poppycock. The Europeans were getting the oil and the Americans wanted the oil, so we had to have a pretext. You can't just say, well, look, ladies and gentlemen, we're going over to Iraq to steal their oil. That isn't going to fly. So you have to wrap it up in the context of, well, gee, the terrorists from Iraq are threatening our way of life and we've got to go over there and make the region safe for democracy. That caused a split on our side because, you see, the Europeans are out competing for that oil, which is now at $55 a barrel. The Chinese are competing for it. You see, everybody in the world wants that oil. And the oil is in dwindling supply. At least all the cheap oil is in dwindling supply. And as I've mentioned earlier, there's no shortage of oil on planet Earth. There's a 500-year supply of oil for us Americans right here in the United States. We just have to work hard to get it. The easy, cheap oil is in Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Kuwait, and Iran. And we don't want to work. We want to go take it. Well, so do the Europeans. And the Europeans have been slighted. We took away from them that oil. We took away from the Chinese that oil. When we get down to this battle of Armageddon that we see spoken of here, talked about here in the book of Revelation, it's going to be over Middle Eastern oil. That's the prize on planet Earth. And the people that are sitting on it are these Arabs. They're sitting on top of the greatest prize on planet Earth. Trillions and trillions of dollars are sitting right there under those sands. The Europeans want it. The Asians want it. The Americans want it. And right now, the Americans are making the move to take it. And we put a puppet government into Iraq, and the Iraqis don't like it. We put a puppet government into Afghanistan. Think about it for a minute. They had about 18 or 20 candidates running for office in Afghanistan. The guy that won, or is going to win when they finish counting the ballots, is Karzai. Karzai sat on the board of directors of Union Oil Company. So after we got through in Afghanistan, we installed Karzai as our puppet president or prime minister, whatever you call it. And everybody else in the world can see that. Maybe the average American doesn't see it, but everybody else in the world looks over there and says, oh, this guy Karzai is an American puppet. So we staged an election. And Karzai got three-quarters of the money. We financed the election, gave Karzai three-quarters of the money for the popularity contest, and the other 18 candidates got to share the other 25%. Well, guess who won the election? Duh. Think about that. Now, we call this democracy. Well, in America, we know that you can buy a seat. For instance, Alan Cranston, back in the 70s or 80s, was running for the Senate out in California, and he spent in the neighborhood of $25 million. Well, in those days, a Senate seat was paying about $60,000 or $80,000 a year. Now, who in his right mind spends $26 million to get a job, to win a job that pays $80,000 a year? I mean, come on, boys and girls, let's grow up and get real. Those Senate seats have a price tag on them, and a Senate seat in California costs a whole lot more than a Senate seat in North or South Dakota. And the guy that advertises the most, that's why these political parties need all of this money, and that's why the corporations and these front groups, you know, like the lobbying groups, companies, law firms like Kissinger and Associates, that's where the money's at. The money is in bribery. We call it lobbying or campaign contributions. But the bottom line is we're looking for power. Power. And we want to control people. And if you control people with a dictator like Saddam Hussein, well, that doesn't sound good here in the West. But if you control people through money, politics and democracy, that's all right. We Americans can buy into that. So we don't have a problem with Karzai in office, an American puppet who has been put in office by America, kept in office, and his office bought by the money for the campaign for the presidency of Afghanistan. And we call that a free and fair election. Isn't that just special? Now, here in the United States, we have a two-party system. All the money goes to the Republicans and Democrats. And everybody else is locked out. When you saw those debates, you didn't see any other people debating. That's a corporation. That debate was a corporation of the Republicans and Democrats, and it froze everybody else out. And yet they tell us in the mainstream media that this is freedom on the march. This is democracy. This is what we want. Well, okay, don't let me get in the way of your happiness and success. But whether you control people with a dictatorship or a monarchy or a democracy, they're just as controlled. Now, are these people being controlled for their benefit, or are they being controlled for the benefit of the controllers? Who's going to get the money from the oil? The people of Iraq or the governmental officials, the Americans and the puppets that are in office? When Saddam Hussein was in office, he got the oil money, and we didn't like that. So we come along and say, well, gee, he's a dirty dictator building palaces for himself and starving his people. Take a look at democracy in Nigeria. Since the oil money has been flowing into Nigeria, it goes to the democratically elected officials, and the people are poorer today than they were before the oil was discovered. So just because there's a lot of wealth in a country doesn't mean whether it's a democracy or a dictatorship, that the people are going to benefit. And you can see that in the United States. We've got a democracy. And who benefits? Well, the Fortune 500 companies benefit from it, not you and me. And nobody's going to be voting any more diligently than the American people. We are glued to the debates. We are glued to our political process. Now, reopening the U.S.-Iraq files. Across Europe, the entire Bush presidential military escapade in Iraq is seen as a grotesque miscalculation in Europe. All they have to do in Europe to confirm that to themselves is to look up in their files what the U.S. had thought would happen in Iraq. These files being based upon official U.S. papers and public statements. And in these files, your newspaper files and TV files, you will find it stated that the Bush administration officials expected to start reducing the number of their armed forces in Iraq by late summer of 2003, leading quickly to a situation in which no more than 30,000 Americans remained in Iraq as a stabilization force. Over a year later, the Europeans know, even though the U.S. won't acknowledge it, that even with 130,000 troops, the U.S. is losing the initiative to an insurgency that seems to have come out of nowhere. Now, Kerry wants to become president. So he says, hey, listen, you elect me president, all you Democrats out there. Come on, vote for me, and I'll go over to Europe, and I'll get the Europeans and NATO to go over there to Iraq, and that's the way we'll disengage. Now, I'm showing you here that that isn't going to happen. That's a fiction. That's just poppycock. But a lot of people are going to vote for John Kerry based upon his statement that, hey, listen, you know, this Bush administration, they're not getting multinational support. Well, that's true. That's true. Bush, on the other hand, he's trying to get multinational support. Well, maybe it's belated. Maybe it's after the fact. But he's out here working to do the same thing. My point is, the war in Iraq is going badly because it was a bad idea. It was a distraction to keep you and me from asking hard questions about how are we going to solve the Social Security deficit, Medicare deficit, and inflation and our economy. As old Bill Clinton used to say, it's the economy, stupid. Bill Clinton was the beneficiary of the George Bush initiatives in 1990, 91, and 92 to stimulate the economy. And the only thing they can stimulate the economy with is to print more money. It's the Keynes philosophy of prime the pump that started with FDR back in 1933. Nothing's changed. On rereading these files full of the claims by the Bush administration and the advocates for war in Iraq, the Europeans see starkly the disastrous shear between what the people in power expected to happen and what did happen and is still happening in Iraq. The Bush administration expected a cakewalk. They expected to be greeted with flowers thrown in the streets. But what the Europeans really fear is that the U.S., which can be so badly, or can so badly miscalculate the consequences of its actions, will miscalculate again with disastrous global, geopolitical, and geostrategic consequences. And they fear that another U.S. mistake will spill over into Europe, and that's why their hopes, such as they are for a U.S. Kerry administration, are very low. So the Europeans want Kerry rather than Bush. Now, I'm sitting over here saying, and I have for a long time, that how in the world is that going to change anything? There are some third-party candidates that are proposing changes, but I haven't heard anybody say, look, let's get off of paper money and go back to gold and silver, which is what George Washington and our founding fathers did. They got off of paper, confetti, in 1787 and went to gold and silver coin. When are we going to solve the Social Security problem by closing Social Security down, period? and quit robbing everybody of 16% of everything they create and produce? When are we going to abolish the income tax and stop these government giveaway programs? The answer is we're not going to. And if we don't, then there's a consequence that comes from it. The consequence that I've been telling you about in this series of programs that historically we've watched in Argentina, Brazil, Bolivia, Peru, Germany, China, Japan. It's going to happen to us. And we've been told that for years and years. And everybody deep down inside looks around and says, my God, can this go on forever? The politicians tell us, yeah, sure it can. Vote for me. And that's what we want to hear. And we buy, and this is your five buying signs, vanity, jealousy, lust, greed, and fear. And every salesman is looking for one of your buying signs. Politicians are buying your votes. They buy the votes from the old folks by giving them free drugs. They buy the votes of voters. I'll get you a job. I'll get out of Vietnam, or I'll get out of Iraq. I will do this. I will do that. Wait a minute. I thought that the electorate was the sovereign power and the politicians worked for the electorate. What I see here is the politicians in power pandering to the electorate, telling you, if you'll vote for me, then I'll do this for you. Well, aren't they buying your votes then? I mean, if you're the master and that's your servant, does your servant come into you and buy your vote? Across the channel in Great Britain, Prime Minister Tony Blair has narrowly escaped a situation in which the British labor unions were in full rebellion against him and his war in Iraq. The labor unions threatened to place on the party conference agenda a call for the full withdrawal of the British troops from Iraq. Now, they didn't make good on this threat. In the British House of Commons, there is an attempt to have Prime Minister Blair impeached. The procedure has not been used in Great Britain since 1805, but it's still in the habits and the mores of the House, as well as in the volumes of law. And as was stated by a lord in the House of Lords, if the Commons wish it, it'll be done. If Tony Blair is impeached after a debate and a vote in the House of Commons, the actual trial will be held in the House of Lords, with the Commons acting as the prosecution. This is not likely to happen, but there is a possibility of a debate in the House of Commons. The father of the House, for example, the longest sitting member of the House, is an advocate for this debate. And in Britain, this matters greatly. Such a debate would devastate Tony Blair's political standing. Now, what do you think would happen if the British pulled out of Iraq? Where would that leave us? Now, three or four little countries have been bludgeoned out of the game, such as the Philippines and a couple, three other little ones. They just had a few people over there, just a little token military presence. And when some of their nationals got kidnapped, they folded up like a house of cards. And if the insurgents over there play hardball, the ultimate end of this is that the British, they don't have the stomach for this either. The British and the Americans, we're not tough like we used to be. In the old days, when we had principles to fight for, we could be really tough. It's pretty hard to fight for money. Oil. It's something that these Iraqis are fighting for. They're fighting for principle. They're fighting for their homeland. They're fighting for their God. They're fighting for their religion. These people are serious. These people are willing to give up. They're willing to blow themselves up for their beliefs and their principles. Do you have Americans that are willing to die in Iraq for principles, for right and wrong, righteousness, good and bad? Stand by. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. You know, we Americans talk a lot about private business, and we use terms like private ownership and private property, private rights, but we also use terms like stocks, bonds, negotiable instruments, licenses, and permits in our pursuit of profit and gain in our business transactions. Well, listen to this. Did you know that stocks and negotiable instruments are the exact opposite to private ownership, and bonds are the exact opposite to private property? Public business licenses are the exact opposite to private rights, and permits are the exact opposite to private business. And why is it that we see small business being subjected to such a constant barrage of attacks by government at every level, from Washington to your hometown? And what can you do to protect your life, your liberty, and your property from these incessant attacks by OSHA, the EPA, the State Tax Commission, Zoning and Planning, the IRS, and the swarms of government agents and agencies that are eating out your substance? Well, you know, there's a lot that we can do, and the first step is to inform ourselves as to the legal alternatives that we have between public business and private business. Now, if you'd like to learn more about private business, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package, and let me tell you more about what it is that you're not supposed to know about private business. The package is educational, it's entertaining, it's informative, best of all, it's free of charge, and you can call and order yours right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. If you're online, just go to the website, georgegordon.org. Click on to the email and send me an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, we're reviewing the privateer issue 511. Now, the privateer is available from Australia. I recommend it highly. It's many times people will say to me, God, that's depressing. Yeah, the truth sometimes is depressing, but would you rather know the Titanic's going to sink, or would you rather believe it's unsinkable and sink with it? I mean, it's a case of either know what to do and how to do it, or you'll be taken by surprise. And I guess most people would rather be surprised. The publisher is William Buckler, P.O. Box 2004, Noosa Heads, Queensland, 4567 in Australia. I'll give you that once more. That's William Buckler. And the post office box is 2004. And the town is Noosa Heads, N-O-O-S-A, Heads, H-E-A-D-S, two words, Queensland, Australia. And the zip code is 4567. Now, you can get online and go to their website. It's www.the-privateer.com. Again, that's www.the-privateer, P-R-I-V-A-T-E-E-R. com. And the email is capt@the-privateer.com. capt@theprivateer. It's $180 a year, 25 issues, comes out twice a month. And I can only cover an issue every once in a while. I can't take the time, you know, to cover every issue of the privateer or the money changer. I'll take an article out of money changer and an article or a topic out of privateer or something and introduce you to it. My point is that there is some real news out there. There are sources of real information, hard information, that you need to make hard, fast, intelligent decisions. As I mentioned last time, many times people call here and say, the news is so bad, I don't know what to do. Listen, the news that's bad, if you take advantage of it, turns out to be good. Big fortunes were made during the Depression years of the 1930s. I'm not down on depressions. There are businesses that do well in boom times, like the Gap, and then there are businesses that do well in depressed times, like your local neighborhood bar. People in depressed times drink more alcohol, so people in distressed times buy more used than they do new, so take advantage of it. Now, if you're in debt, and you're sitting there saying, oh, woe is me, and I don't know what to do next, write for my free general law CD package, and let me tell you how to perk yourself up. I teach a business school, and I'm expecting to make profit off of the depression. The devaluation of the dollar has made me money over the last 3 years because I got out of dollars and I got into gold. And my gold investments have moved from $275 to $400. And I avoided the losses of the dollar. I passed those on like the old maid in a card game to somebody else. And I recommend that you do the same thing. That's what Buffett's doing. He's getting out of dollars. Well, he probably already has. Smart money is getting out of dollars. I reported here in the Privateer, the Chinese are getting out of dollars. Now, they've got more than anybody else. They're buying. You want to know why oil is $55 a barrel? The Chinese are buying oil tankers full of oil and parking them in their ports. Their thinking is, might as well get rid of these worthless dollars on something rather than nothing. And so, there's a global shortage of oil. The oil wells are pumping at breakneck speed, and everybody is scrambling to get everything they can, move everything that they can out of dollars. Well, if everybody else in Europe and Asia is waiting for the inevitable collapse of the dollar, the last people to know are going to be the Americans, aren't they? Now, the G7 meeting, plus China and Russia, which turns the G7 into the G9, could end up being one of those where the final communique, normally drafted and approved by all of the participants weeks in advance of the actual meeting, might end up being written in great haste on the back of a napkin. But if the U.S. delegation suddenly discovered that the official inflows of money from Asia would no longer be arriving and that the U.S. dollar faced its greatest crisis since 1971, when Richard Nixon disconnected the dollar from gold. This is not likely to happen this time, but it could. Now, the U.S. has been getting a global free ride on the international reserve currency, the status of the U.S. dollar, and we've been doing that for decades. And it has grossly abused the special standing of our currency, which is currently and really just the national paper money of the United States, a fiat currency. The United States thought it could perpetually increase the quantity of these U.S. dollars without consequence. It has now proven to be very wrong. All right, let's take a look now at the global monetary report, the global market report. First, the IMF and now the G7. When the G7 talks, is anybody listening? That was the headline to an article penned by Mr. Glenn Somerville, which appeared on Yahoo on October the 2nd. It was the top story on the Yahoo Business news site on Saturday, October the 2nd. If you haven't already seen it, have a look using the URL above. The key quotes in the story, both of them from chief economists from well-known international investment firms. Here's what they were. Quote, the fact is the center of global economic activity has shifted away from the G7, and that will be increasingly the case as we go forward into the future. In this particular time of our history, the biggest issues involve those outside of the G7. For the past two G7 meetings, the one in Dubai in September of 2003, and then the one in Boca Raton, Florida in February of 2004, the privateer has issued a warning that the G7, which has in effect been ineffectual for years now, is rapidly nearing the point where it is seen to be ineffectual. And as the headline above and many other reports, analyses of the latest G7 meeting in Washington attest, that point has now arrived in history. This is what the privateer had to say in issue 494 about that situation in the lead-up to the last G7 meeting, the one which took place in Boca Raton on February the 7th, 2004. Here's what they said. Quote, the dollar has bounced off the bottom of its downtrend. The Dow is at the top of its downtrend. For the fix to be truly in, U.S. investors in particular expect to see the dollar continue to recover and the Dow to break above the last of its downtrend lines and to go on to challenge its highs of early 2000. Any other outcome would court a loss of confidence, and that would raise the stakes to the point where even the G7 would be unable to either address or fix the problem, unquote. All right, now that was back in February of 2004. Well, in fact, the fix did go in on the U.S. dollar in the wake of that G7 meeting. And a little over a week after the meeting, the U.S. dollar index reached 85.12, which has since proved to be its 2004 low so far. Now, the U.S. dollar's recovery, however, has not been very robust. On October 1st, 2004, the U.S. dollar index closed at 87.66. The U.S. stock market has not fared even that well. At the time of the Florida G7 meeting, the Dow was trading at almost 10,600. At the beginning of this week, on September 27th, the Dow dipped back below 10,000 for the first time since mid-August, before regaining 10,000 by the end of the week. Now, the fact that the G7 is having less and less effect on world markets and currencies is interesting, but it is not the vital issue. The vital issue is that now the G7 has joined the international lender of last resort, the IMF, as being seen to be ineffectual. And this is completing the process by which the two major global adjudicators of the system of fiat money and floating exchange rates have lost all of their credibility. Now, the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, is the child of the Bretton Woods Conference of 1944. The conference, which set the post-World War II course for the international economy, the ostensible purpose, of course, of the IMF with the help of the U.S. dollar as the world's sole reserve currency, was to return the world to the era of stable currencies, which had been so rudely shattered by the events of the late 1920s and the 1930s. The aim of the IMF was laid out in Clause 3 of Article 1 of the document, which created the International Monetary Fund. It was to promote exchange stability, to maintain orderly exchange arrangements among members, and to avoid competitive exchange depreciation. Now, the IMF worked well for 25 years. In the late 1940s and 50s, the Western nations, which had been physically devastated by World War II, began crawling out of the rubble and rebuilding Europe after World War II. In the 1960s, the United States embarked upon a policy of guns and butter, trying to combine a war in Vietnam with a gigantic welfare state called the Great Society, and the U.S. government and trade deficits began to blow out, and the pressure on the reserve currency, the U.S. dollar, greatly increased. But under the Bretton Woods Agreement, which had spawned the International Monetary Fund, the U.S. dollar was tied to gold at a ratio of $35 per ounce, and the United States pledged to redeem dollars for gold to foreign governments and central banks only. By May of 1971, foreign central banks held about $32 billion in dollar reserves. And by the beginning of August of 1971, the gold holdings of the U.S. Treasury, now that's the gold that we held, valued at $35 an ounce, had dwindled to less than $10 billion. The foreign central banks had been redeeming dollars for gold, even though they knew that if they kept doing this, they would destroy the Bretton Woods Agreement. That's the greed factor in human nature. And that's what the Chinese are doing right now. You see, the Chinese are sitting over there with $450 billion. And they're watching the American economy implode. And they're saying to themselves, when this thing implodes, we're going to be left sitting here holding the old maid. We need to get rid of these dollars. And that's why they're on a buying binge. And one of the things that they're buying is a lot of oil, right along with the oil tankers to store it in. And they've got the money to do it. In other words, the Chinese today are doing what the Germans and Europeans were doing in the early 1970s. They're raiding. They're taking whatever they can get for whatever they can get. And the only people left that don't know what's going on in the world are the Americans. So that's why I'm raising the alert. I'm telling you, you've got to take some kind of evasive action to protect yourself. Now, I don't care whether you do or don't. I'm not going to get mad at you if you sit by and watch the world go by. I get letters in here all the time that say, you know, Gordon, you're a nut. Well, that's fine. But, you know, that's what people have been saying about the Titanic. You know, I'm sure that the Titanic, built by the low bidder Harlan and Wolff, the unsinkable ship, if you'd have told people, you know, here's what's coming down, they'd have said, hey, you're a nut. It's always been that way. Prior to World War II, all of the signals and signs were there that we're going to war, and people said, what? What? You're a nut. It always happens. But then when the nuts get proven right, well, then, then what do you say? Going on, the Gordian knot was cut by President Nixon on August 15th, 1971. When Nixon declared that the U.S. would no longer permit foreign governments and central banks to redeem dollars for gold. 19 months of increasingly desperate attempts to cobble together a fixed exchange rate, a regime in the absence of gold, ended precipitously in March of 1973, when under the Brussels Agreement, all links between the U.S. dollar and gold were officially abandoned. And with that went Clause 3 of Article 1 of the Charter of the IMF. Competitive exchange depreciation had reemerged with the dawn of floating currencies. Now, the results of these floating currencies is just about to overwhelm the world like it did in the 1930s. I mean, we would like things to be different, but they're not different. And that's why I suggest to all of my listeners and my students that we get on the stick and take evasive action, do something about it. Be sure to write for my free general law CD package. Remember, it doesn't cost you anything. The worst you can do when you get through listening to it is say, this guy is a nut, and forget about it. I mean, you're not going to hurt my feeling. But if a few save themselves from the coming debacle, it would certainly be worth my time, effort, and energy. Now, let's take a look at the Rambouillet, the birth of the G7. In November of 1975, the heads of state of the six leading Western industrial nations, that's the United States and the United Kingdom, along with Germany, France, Italy, and Japan, they met in Rambouillet, France. The purpose of this meeting was an attempt, indeed what proved to be the final attempt, to find some way back from the regime of floating currencies to a fixed exchange rate system again. In essence, it was the Americans who favored floating rates against the French, with the Germans behind them, who favored a return to fixed rates that came out of the meeting, or what came out of the meeting, was not a return to fixed rates, but a nebulous idea that perhaps the regime of floating exchange rates could be made to last through formalized international cooperation. This formalized international cooperation took the form of the G6, then the G7. Now it's called the G8 plus China. In short, the G7 was founded on a last-ditch attempt to bring order back into the chaos of a floating exchange rate worldwide. The attempt failed at Rambouillet in 1975, now that's 29 years ago, and all that remained were the G7 meetings with no substance. Now, what's the end of it? Well, Bretton Woods itself died on August 15, 1971, and was formally buried in March of 1973. What remained was the IMF and the World Bank plus the G7. And like the children of the long-deceased last monarch of a now-deposed royal line, they've been in denial ever since the early 1970s, showing a brave and opulent face to the world while clinging desperately to the echoes of a former glory. Now, the last time that the IMF was seen to have any effect, for good or ill, on global economic and financial events was during the Asian crisis of the late 1990s. They have not been since then, and they have not been seen since, notably during the debt default crisis in Argentina and Brazil in 2002 and 2003. The G7 did not have to do much except keep up the brave and the very opulent face until the U.S. dollar bull market ended at the beginning of 2002. That was almost 3 years ago now, and with every meeting which has taken place since the beginning of 2002, the G7 has shown themselves to be increasingly ineffectual. The effect of the latest meeting is best shown by the quoted headline, which begins this section of the Privateer. The fact is that everyone is listening, but it is their reaction to what they're hearing and not hearing which is so telling. When the credibility of the G7 goes, and it's going very fast, then the game is up. Now, what goes around comes around. In our previous issue, number 510, the Privateer reported that the IMF had declared that the global financial system is now shockproof. Now, the BBC has reported another declaration from the IMF. This one involved world growth. The IMF has revised upwards its forecast of world growth in 2004 from 4.6 to 5% despite rising oil prices. This crows the IMF is the fastest rate of growth since 1973. Now, having read this far, the significance of 1973 should leap off the page for you. Think about it. That's right. 1973 was the first year of the current global regime of floating currencies. It was also the year of the first oil shock. Do you remember that? 31 years later, in 2004, we have rampant global growth fueled by exactly the same thing that fueled growth in 1973. Deficit spending and credit creation led by the United States. And we also have rapidly rising oil prices, just exactly what we had in 1973. Now, welcome to the world of reality, boys and girls. History repeats itself. And those that can't learn from it get crushed by it. That's the point. Now, the problem is that what happened the year after 1973, that is 1974, was the year when the U.S. dollar crashed. U.S. stock markets crashed. U.S. interest rates soared. Gold soared. 1974 was a very bad year. And that will the year after 2005 be like this time? Or what will the year be like after 2005? Well, says the IMF, global growth will be cut to 4.3%. Well, 1973, the first year of the global floating rate regime, was the year when the competitive exchange depreciation, which Bretton Woods was designed to stop, reemerged in full force. And it's never gone away from that day to this. But now, the first echoes of that long-dead fixed-rate regime have reemerged. Now, Bush administration advisors are advocating a 20% devaluation of the U.S. dollar. Did you hear that? They're advocating a 20% devaluation of the U.S. dollar under the old fixed rate regime. Devaluations could and did happen and were an admission of failure by the nation doing the devaluing. Devaluing on a national scale, boys and girls, is bankruptcy. That's what it boils down to. We cannot pay our bills, so we're going to reorder. We're going to rearrange our payment schedule. Now, under a floating rate regime, any such embarrassment was avoided, and the markets set the exchange rate. Well, at least they did according to the IMF and the G7. To even talk about devaluing a currency is an admission that the post-1973 global currency regime is on its last legs. To talk about devaluing the reserve currency is a warning that its demise cannot be postponed very much longer. Now, in recent events, as everyone expected, the Fed raised rates by another quarter point to 1.75% at the September 21st Federal Open Market Committee meeting. The immediate reaction to this was another fall in the U.S. dollar and a U.S. stock market which started falling again, with the Dow closing below 10,000. For the first time since mid-August, it fell below 10,000 on September 27th, and then old habits kicked back in, and the U.S. economic data was a little better than expected, so the G7, IMF, World Bank meetings were relied on to put the fix in, and the IMF world growth figures were celebrated. U.S. and world stock markets duly recovered towards the end of the week. Now, is it going to last until the election? Yeah, it looks that way. We're only a couple of weeks away from the election, and I would guess that unless something pretty dramatic occurs, it'll probably make it. Now, remember James Turk that I quoted you in the Money Changer last week said that he thought that over the next 1, 2, or 3 years at the outside, whether this is going to be a soft landing, that is, we'll devalue the dollar by 20%, which means that imports are going to rise by 25%. In other words, get ready for a rampant inflation. That's the bottom line. That's the best case scenario. And in a worst case scenario, the thing will just collapse like it did in Argentina, with the resulting recession, probably depression, and then tough times. Getting ready for those tough times is the key to individual family success. And in order for you to do that, why don't you write for my free general law CD package and pay attention to my business school. There is business whether there's boom times or bust. There's always business. And you want to be the person who can do business and maintain your standard of living. Hey, I'm about out of time. We're going to have to leave it right there. The opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, and staff of the network of this radio network or this radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, just go to the website. It's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or call the school direct, 417-273-4967. You've been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Remember, we're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the United States and worldwide on the Internet. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Well, there's the signal. It says my time's up. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. Of course, God willing. And we'll be talking about something new, unusual, and different. So until then, good night, friends.